Michael Explains, where I invite you to join the science teaching conversation with me about Leibniz. This is episode one, reading from the Stanford Encyclopedia of Philosophy. So this is like a big sort of a baseline for looking at philosophers. And I've looked at a series of philosophers. I suppose it's Descartes, who's mind and matter and soul and the existence of God. He's a French person. There's Kant, who, I've forgotten the actual name of the little port up in the Baltic Sea, he stayed up there. And, he looked at the, question of, basically had almost a tilt at mathematics, looking at infinity and, the not other, the other and the not other, and the moral logic of it. So he began to try and work out what was the fundamental systematics of moral logic. This is a reaction to the onslaught of Newton, and the idea that you could look at the laws of nature. So if you saw, you could have the laws of moral philosophy. And so I'll have to go back and reread Immanuel Kant from that era, looking at very many different areas, and I've really, having read it once, it's probably worthwhile to go back again. And so Leibniz is actually someone who sits in between Kant and Newton. He's also the father of calculus, and at this time there's sort of emerging maths, and maths is eventually going to overtake this theory on how you deal with the sort of the mathematical aspects of God, you know, what's other and not other. And I have to really get back and reread Kant. One of the things is that I think Kant was so complex that people coming to learn him or trying to examine what he said accidentally discovered other things, and he's sort of like Kant's is the central person of the early Enlightenment, Christian philosopher. And it's interesting to note these stages that everyone here is interested in God, as it's really philosophy as an extension of theology rather than math. So even Newton, he was discovering God's, the way, the workings of God. And so even Newton's force, it was, the actual force was actually generated via God. God looked at the equations and then said, yep, I'll do it. There was actually no mechanistic way. It was actually a description of what's going on. Now, it's interesting to see how maths comes into this, because you've got the monad of Pythagoras and the sacred numbers, and the numbers associated with God. And the monad is a dot with a circle around the outside. Actually, it looks like the hydrogen atom. That's a bit of a spooky aspect. And there's a philosophical tilt between Christianity and classical physics and the need to define things as opposed to quantum physics coming across. So I can see that, having studied both. So I've got this sort of half understanding here, and a understanding of Leibniz. And so Leibniz got very, very important, because in terms of numbers, his fascinating with the number 0 and 1 led to binary, and this led to our modern digital age. So it's so complex to look at and think and contemplate all of this. And the sort of hard thing to do is that people want to have a philosopher which fits into their essay or fits into their own thinking. But when you read into it, they're in their own thinking, they're dealing with their own problems, and dealing with their own problems gives them a certain amount of solution. You can actually see the limit or the extent of what they're talking about. And then you can question how you apply this further forward. And of course, Leibniz is sort of poo-pooed in the English-speaking world as someone who dares to compete with the great Newton. And we've got sort of a rather picture of this good-looking blonde person with a big nose, looking out, and it's so really important. But of course, Newton was really nothing like that. Sort of the impression you get from the textbook and the simplicity of his laws didn't mention it. And in fact, his laws have been mathematized or expanded after his time. In fact, his great person he's competing with was Descartes, who brought up the next level algebraic equation. So you can see all these things coming up. You know, for me, I've read a book on numbers, so it's given me another view, a book, a podcaster book. And unfortunately, this is before I've built my own numbered engine enabling to me to light up the podcast. Very simply, I'm doing a bit of my own research. I'm looking at the number of podcast series I can actually link together. There's a whole series of maths on it. Now, just today, I think I've went through a real low point in being able to podcast. I don't quite know what it is, but I'm sort of rehabbing away, and as you train, you have these bad days. So today's been a bad day, and we're going to see how we go. So let's start reading about Leibniz, and as we find out, he's a Kraut, a German, and let's read about it. It's Gottfried Wilhelm Leibniz. So this was first published on Saturday, the 22nd of December, 2007. I don't know exactly what the author list is, but there's going to be, it's 50 pages long. That's to give you a feel, a tilt at it. I'm going to go for podcastings over a certain length of time. That's why the Stanford Encyclopedia of Philosophy. So they've got here a sort of a generalized standard of almost a Wikipedia, advanced Wikipedia look, not going down any one line or not, but having a consistent story for over 50 pages, and it's text to go across. And so it's by the Stanford University, I suppose. And print it out. Now, let's read this particular person. Gottfried Wilhelm Leibniz was one of the greatest, 1646 to 1716. And again, I'm going to have to get numbers in my head to see how it overlapped with Newton. So, Newton, really, there wasn't the concept, there was the concept of publication. It's not a concept of a scientific community and a publication network, so it's more if you can claim the ideas. And calculus is a very important thing. This is being able to deal with the infinitesimal. Newton had no evidence for it. He just had evidence that he had used the technique. He hadn't communicated the technique, he communicated the results having used this technique, and sort of people, yes, you must have used it before. Leibniz had a bit more thorough use to it, and the story goes that Leibniz falsified, now we do not know if this is true, we'll find out here, falsified documents predating his discovery of calculus, and so that's enough to in the modern scientific era to say, oh, well, let's give it to Newton. But this calculus is a very important aspect. Calculus is, of course, the engine of quantum mechanics to give you the wave function. And the wave functions are a combination of calculus and algebraic numbers. It's a differential equations, essentially, the mix of those two together. Of the 18th century, he's known as the last universal genius. And that's amazing. So I have to understand where Descartes comes in. He made deep, important contributions to the field of metaphysics, epistemology, which is religion, or the ideas of religion, logic, philosophy of religion, as well as mathematics, physics, geology, jurisprudence, and history. Even the 18th century atheist and materialist Denis Diderot, whose views were very often at odds with Leibniz, could not help being awed by his achievement, writing in his entry on Leibniz in the Encyclopedia, quote, "Perhaps never has a man read as much, studied as much, meditated more, and written more than Leibniz. What he has composed on the world, God, nature, and the soul is of the most sublime eloquence. As the idea has been expressed with a flair of Plato, the philosopher of Leipzig would see nothing to other philosophers of Athens. Which obviously my interest in philosophy, I'm not saying I'm on the same level, but there's certain things that I can see now with the maths that I have, which are sort of semi-philosophical maths. Okay. Indeed, Diderot was almost moved to despair in this piece. Quote, "When one compares the talents one has with those of Leibniz, one is tempted to throw away one's books and go die quietly in the dark of some forgotten corner." More than a century later, Gottlob Frege, it's spelled G-O-T-T-L-O-B, Frege, who fortunately did not cast his books away in despair, expressed similar admiration, declaring that in his writing, Leibniz threw out such a profusion of seeds of ideas that in this respect he is virtually in a class of his own. Bue's logical calculus and the concept script in posthumous writings. The aim of this entry is primarily to introduce Leibniz's life and summarize and explicate his views in the realms of metaphysics, epistemology, and philosophical theology. So you must ask yourself, if he is so admired at the time, how come, if you mention Leibniz, people might know Kant, they wouldn't know Leibniz. Say if you were in a science staff room and you said Leibniz, no one would know it. So you must ask yourself, why is this so? Note that throughout this entry, the following standard abbreviations are used. PC for principle of contradiction, and I'll have to remember these bloody things. PSR, principle of sufficient reason. PII, principle of identity of indiscernibles. PIN, predicate in notion principle. And CIC, complete individual concept. That sounds really good. I was just trying to think. It looks as though this is going to be a bit more thorough than Descartes, who, bless his soul, would come up with the definition of truth is that it just is, feels clear and it feels true. And of course, this is obviously going to be a different treatise, and there's a huge amount of work here. So you're going to have a few breaks because I've turned off the digital silence reduction, and I'll have to reintroduce that in the software. But that's just a nightmare. It can easily be done in Lame, but how it's done and how well it's done is another thing. Noise reduction, automatic noise reduction. So I've turned it off on the dictaphone, so you'll hear me silence as I churn through the pages here. And the reason I've done it is that listening to it, it can be a bit too aggressive and block things off. I don't know why that's so. Now, one. So there's going to be one. I know there's at least up to seven here, but one section is a life. Leibniz was born in Leipzig on the 1st of July, 1646. 2 years prior to the end of the 30 Years' War, which had ravaged Central Europe. Now, what is the 30 Years' War? I really can't remember. I can't remember whether it's the Protestants versus Catholic War or whether it was one of the succession wars. Hopefully they'll tell me this. His family was Lutheran and belonged to an educated elite from both sides. His father, Friedrich Leibniz, was a jurist and professor of moral philosophy at the University of Leipzig. His mother, Katrina Schmuck, S-H-U-M-U-C-K, was the daughter of a professor of law. Now, just have to really get my brain around this. Leibniz's father died in 1652, so let's look at that. That's when he's six. And subsequent education, which is interesting because Descartes' father died early. His subsequent education was directed by his mother, uncle, and according to his own reports himself. He was given access to his father's extensive library at a young age and proceeded to pore over its contents, particularly the volumes of ancient history and the church fathers. In 1661, so let's do their math there, that's 4 to 14, Lübeck's began to formally university education at the University of Leipzig as the modern philosophy of Descartes, Galileo, and Cassini, Hobbes, and others had not made a great impact by this time in the German-speaking lands. Lübeck's philosophical education was chiefly scholastic in nature. So scholastics go through the texts line by line. These are, so there are a certain amount of texts which have got a gold medal on it from the Pope. Go through them line to line. If you find a contradiction, you find out not that, that they're contradictory, but in fact you are wrong. Scholasticism by St. Thomas Aquinas is excellent, but I do like the, there's some, it wouldn't peep it because there are some really, excessively good traits of thoroughness and completeness in it. Though he was exposed to elements of the Renaissance humanism, while Leipzig, and while in Leipzig, Leibniz met Jacob Thomasius, who would have an important influence on Leibniz, and who supervised Leibniz's first philosophical treatise on the principle of individualization. It was Thomas's more than anyone else who perhaps instilled the Leibniz a great respect for the ancient medieval philosophy. Indeed, one of the leitmotifs of Leibniz's philosophical career is his desire to reconcile modern philosophy with the philosophy of Aristotle, Plato, and the Scholastics, and the Renaissance humanist transition, as you do, rather than me just saying, that's no good. After receiving a bachelor's from Leipzig, he continued his studies at the University of Altdorf. While there, Leibniz published in 1666 a remarkably original dissertation on the arts of combination, a work that sketched a plan for a universal characteristics and logical calculus, a subject that would occupy him for much of the rest of his life. Leibniz was offered a position at the Faculty of Law. Upon the completion of his Doctorate of Law in 1667, he had a different future in mind. In that year, Leibniz met Baron Johann Christian von Boyneberg, a Protestant Catholic convert to Catholicism, who was able to secure a position for Leibniz with the Elector of Mainz. Now, remember, I visited Mainz, sort of, they're all typically really clean German cities. While in the court of the Elector, Leibniz composed a series of works in philosophical theology, the Catholic demonstrations, which are other manifestations of Leibniz's lifelong Irenicism. Well, there you go. I don't know what Irenicism is. Now it's going to be in my brain to see if I can remember that. I don't think I can. You know what? I can't remember those PC, CIC, I can't remember what they stand for. It's all gone. Okay, this is going to really be a good test for him. In this case, what is Irenicism? In this case, in their attempt to provide a basis for the justification for the reconciliation of Protestantism and Catholicism, Leibniz also turned his mind to natural philosophy, having finally been able to study some works of the moderns, the result of a two-part treatise in 1671. The new physical hypothesis, Hypothesis Physica Nova, the first part, Theory of Abstract Motion, Theoretica Motor Abstracti, was dedicated to the Academie des Arts of Paris, and the second part, Theory of Concrete Motion, was dedicated to the Royal Society in London. The works, however, are not likely to impress their audience, for, given the circumstances, Leibniz could not produce, produce amateur works in the field. Okay. So, perhaps that's the main thing with me, in terms of I have to be aware that as far as professional people are concerned, I'm an amateur at the internet and all this type of stuff. This changed, however, in 1672, when Leibniz was given a single most important opportunity of his life. The Elector of Mainz sent him on a diplomatic mission to Paris, the center of learning and science at the time. Leibniz was able to stay in Paris for 4 years, with a brief trip to London in 1653. Does that make him, could he have met Newton, during which time he met many of the major figures of the intellectual world, among them Annette Arnauld, Nicholas Malebranche. Now, I do remember Malebranche, and the most important mathematician and physicist, Christian Huygens. Now, Huygens' wavelets is interesting. It was he, the great Huygenius, John Lukey would call him at the dedicatory epistle in his essay concerning human understanding, who took Leibniz under his wing and tutored him in the developments of the in developments in philosophy, physics, and maths. Not only was Leibniz able to converse with some of the greatest minds of the 17th century while in Paris, he was also given access to unpublished manuscripts of Descartes and Pascal. And, according to Leibniz, it was while reading the mathematical manuscripts of Pascal that he began to see that what would eventually become a differential calculus and his work of infinite series. Now, isn't that great? Okay. In this time, Leibniz also designed a calculating machine able to perform addition, subtraction, multiplication, and division, which is a really, really a fantastic thing. I can remember that reading in maths. The trip to London in 1673 was meant to be in part to present his designs to the Royal Society. While Leibniz was living, and this is all to do with being able to do calculations of the nautical calculations. So that's really interesting. While Leibniz was living the life in the mind of the mind of Paris, his employer died, and Leibniz was thus forced to look for another position. He eventually found as a librarian for Duke Johann Frederick of Brunswick, who ruled over Hanover. On the way to Hanover, Leibniz stops in Amsterdam to meet Spinoza. Oh, I'd love to understand Spinoza. I might do another one on him between November 18th and 21. It's spinoidal decomposition. What the heck does that mean? In 1676, 3 months before the latter's death, according to Leibniz's own note, they spoke of Spinoza's yet-to-be-published Ethics, Cartesian Physics, and Leibniz's improved version of ontological argument, see below. Although Leibniz would travel to Italy for a time in the late 1680s in order to conduct historical research for the House of Hanover and make shorter trips, including to Vienna, the rest of his life was essentially spent in Hanover and its environments. I wish I knew where Hanover was. It's not Hamburg, Hanover. And Hanover is where the Pied Piper was. Typical German place. Working in different capacities for the court, from Johann Friedrich until his death in 1680, then John Friedrich's brother Ernest August, from 1680 to 89, and finally the little son, George Ludwig, who in 1714 would become George I of England. What? That's a bit of a gobsmacker. What the heck's going on? So the Georges really are krauts, aren't they? Leibniz's relations with Ernest and George Ludwig were not as amicable as his relationship with his original employer, but he was close to Sophie, his wife, the wife of Ernest Auguste, the younger sister, and Princess Elizabeth of Bohemia, with whom Descartes had an important philosophical correspondence. It is also really interesting to see the women in Descartes, how the women sort of a social glue. It's also true for the women were an important communication network for the missionaries, the early Christian missionaries who came down to convert the Germans. Matilda, there was my memory's going. There was Saint Matilda, there was another saint. Oh, I just have to go across. Okay, while Leibniz may have felt physically isolated from the intellectual scene of Europe, he did manage to stay connected through a vast network of correspondence. Leibniz exchanged letters with over 1,100 different people in the course of his life. Despite the great demands placed on Leibniz as a librarian, then historian, and privy councillor in the court of Hanover, he was able to complete work that, in breadth and depth and sheer quantity, is staggering. Oh, good on you. Well, yeah. Leibniz's final years were bleak. He was engaged in vituperate debate with Newton's, what a dickhead, and his followers of the priority of the discovery of calculus, even being accused of stealing Newton's ideas. Most historians of mathematics now claim that Newton and Leibniz developed their ideas independently. Newton developed his ideas first, and Leibniz was the first to publish. And at the court, he was mocked for his wig and old-fashioned clothing. Think 1670s Paris party. When George became George, the acrimony surrounding Leibniz in England was so great that Leibniz was asked to remain and have a rather follow his employer to London. Leibniz died in November 1716. Well, that's like a wow. I'm sure, like the young people I speak to, they just know this history back to front. But for me, it's just, well, I knew that George's came from the Krautmans, but I didn't actually know it was George. Georg. That's how they used to... Georg. Okay. Chronology of major writings. So, 1684, Meditation of Knowledge, Truth and Ideas. 1686, Discourse on Metaphysics. 1686F, for some reason, Correspondence with Arnold. These are really great things, whereas they're compared to ancient things like letters to Leviticus and things like that, they're just put out the cat and things like that. But these are really big, interesting letters to read. Primary Truths in 89, A New System in 95, so he had a six-year gap there. Look, chapters goes on for a fair while. Specimen Dionysium, on the ultimate origin of things, on the nature of itself, or nature itself, correspondence with De Volder, new essays on human understanding, correspondence with De Bosses, Theodicy, Monology, principles of nature and grace, correspondence with Clark. Now, yeah, this is one of the things that when you're out of the system, it's really hard to actually strike up correspondence. People are just, I think the problem is the internet now, just, you know, people just, you just get down their mail list, and if you've got something heavy and deep, sort of, I blame Gmail, making it difficult. He would have been stuffed if he had Gmail. Okay, this is section 2, and we're up to 27 minutes. Overview of Leibniz's philosophy. Unlike most of the great philosophers of the period, Leibniz did not write a magnum opus, a single work. There's no single work that can be said to contain the core of his thought. While he did produce two books, Theodicy and New Essays Concerning Human Understanding, finished in 1704 but not published until 1765, the students of Leibniz's thought must piece together Leibniz's philosophy from a myriad of writings, essays published in scholarly journals and more popular journals, unpublished works left abandoned by the author, and as many letters. Well, there you go. That's why he's not known in the staff rooms of science at school. Moreover, many of Leibniz's writings have not yet been published. The authoritative scholarly version of Leibniz's works, the Alchemy edition, has thus far only been published his philosophical writings from 1663 to 1690. In other words, only half his writing life has been covered. And the mere act of dating pieces often depends on careful analysis of the paper Leibniz wrote on, and the watermarks on it. Hence, for example, the important short work, Primary Truth, which, because of its content, is often thought to date from 1686. Has recently been redated by editors to 1689 because of the watermark. Piecing together Leibniz's philosophy into a systematic whole is made more difficult because Leibniz seems to have changed or at least refined his views on a number of issues over the course of his career, and because he was always very aware, some might say too aware, of his audience for any of the audience of any of his writings. And look, I think he would benefit enormously from my corrugated number system. Now, this is the one of the things is that when you're working hard, you can't just sort of like a lawnmower, you sort of set to so many dB. You know, people expect you to be a machine and just work within a bounds of certain creativity or work. But he obviously hasn't. And as a structural system, we nowadays would surround him with editors and publishers. And it's interesting now you've struck up a relationship with a publisher or a group, or you don't. You don't, and at least that gives you some sort of feedback. It doesn't seem so. He's just prolifically producing, which, when you really come to think of it, might explain that he wasn't limited by it. If he had a word processor, he probably would have crashed and died. As stated above, Leibniz's intellectual training was squarely in the tradition of Scholasticism and Renaissance Humanism. His background then was of Aristotelism, Platonism, and Orthodox Christianity, which is very interesting, and which means that he would actually probably go further, because he's encountering the new stuff from a solid background. Yet as he became more familiar with modern philosophy in the 17th century, he became to see many of its virtues. Although there is some reason to be sceptical of the details, the spirit of self-portrait Leibniz paints to Nicolas Rebon in 1714 can be a helpful guide for approaching his work. He writes about himself. Okay, and I'm not going to put on a German Krautish accent. I feel almost tempted to. I have tried to uncover and unite the truth buried and scattered under the opinions of all the different philosophical sects, and I believe I have added something of my own which takes a few steps forward. The circumstances under which my studies proceed from my earliest youth have given me some faculty in this. I discovered Aristotle as a lad, and even Scholastics did not repel me. Even now, I do not regret this. But then Plato too and Plotinus gave me some satisfaction, not to mention other ancient thinkers whom I consulted later. Well, gosh, okay, that's giving you too much insight. But I must admit, I like reading Plato and Republic and stuff like that. After finishing the trivial schools, I fell upon the moderns, and I recall walking in a grove on the outskirts of Leipzig called the Rosenthal at the age of 15 and celebrating whether to perceive substantial forms or not. This is by the age of 15, so this is, you know, pre-HSC. What are we talking about? Mechanisms finally prevailed and led me to apply myself to mathematics. But I looked for the ultimate reasons for the mechanisms and even for the laws of motion. I was greatly surprised to see that they could not be found in mathematics, but that I should have to return to metaphysics, which essentially is what Newton did as well. I mean, this is the scandal of how we teach Newton, and it means we can't understand it. If we teach Newton as if he wasn't looking at metaphysics, you actually seal off your ability to teach people about Newton in the future. It's sort of like this, it's like, oh, I don't know, it's teaching just with the bad straight. This led me back to the entelechies, and from the material, I don't know what that word is, and from the material to the formal. And at last brought me to understand, after many corrections and forward steps in my thinking, that monads are the idea of Plato. That's what a dot with a circle, the essence of something existing, the point. Our simple substances are only true substances, and material things are only phenomena, though well-founded and well-connected. Of this, Plato and even the later academics and the skeptics too had caught some glimpses. I flatter myself to have penetrated into the harmony of these different realms and to have seen both sides are right, provided they do not clash with each other. That everything in nature happens mechanically and at the same time metaphysically, but that the source of mechanics is metaphysics. which is essentially what Newton says. And it's, ah, I just find it very, very frustrating that people haven't studied Newton. Okay, again, there is some reason to doubt whether Leibniz was really 15 when he had made the philosophical preambulations, or whether, and to what, extent he had actually read any of the moderns. Nevertheless, the self-portrait does express something that one sees in Leibniz's writings, the weaving together of various strands of ancient and modern philosophies in a remarkably creative and sophisticated manner. Well, yeah, why would, I mean, if you look at when it's written, why would one make that up? I mean, it would make it up, but I mean, why do people make up these things about their lives? The letter to Raymond makes it clear that Leibniz had reservations about certain aspects of modern philosophy, qualms that arose from and led back to his eclectic mix of Aristotle and Christian Platonism. So Plato, that means Platonism is that we are all elements in God's mind. And the idea of forms. It is possibly the most helpful, then, to see Leibniz's philosophy as a reaction to two sets of modern opponents. On one hand, Descartes and his followers. On the other hand, Hobbes and Spinoza. I know about Descartes. Well, this is really interesting, but I really don't know about Hobbes and Spinoza. Leibniz's critics of Descartes and his followers was focused principally on Cartesian account of bodies and corporal substances. According to Descartes, the essence of body is extension, that is, corporal substances are simply a geometric object made concrete, and other objects have size, shape, and is in motion. In his view, indeed, the cornerstone of new mechanical philosophy to which Leibniz was originally attracted, which is interesting because this Descartes is actually a bit closer to quantum mechanics. Nevertheless, Leibniz came to see two distinct problems with this view. First, claiming that the essence of a body is extension, Descartes is endorsing the view that matter is infinitely divisible. But if matter is infinitely divisible, then one can never arrive at simple unities that must exist from an ontological ground level. Well, yeah, I don't know. The wave function is divisible because you can actually divide it with your head. But practically, physically, it's not. It's one of those things. It's conceptual things. Secondly, if matter is simply an extension, there is, in its nature, no source of activity. If it is so, Leibniz thought, then bodily objects of the world cannot account for substances. Hobbes and Spinoza, despite their own differences, advanced, or were read as advancing, a number of objectionable and deeply troubling these which Leibniz and most of his contemporaries saw as an enormous threat. Materialism, atheism, necessitism. It is Leibniz's response to Hobbesian and Spinozic necessitism. Necessitism. It sounds sort of like stuff you get in the education department. We have to change this form. We have to do this. We have to, because of it's a necessity. But I really want to read that. It's perhaps the greatest interest, for he thought to develop an account of action and contingency that Leibniz's philosophical view that God freely chose the best world from an infinite number of possible worlds, and that a person could be said to act freely when the contrary of the action does not imply a contradiction. This topic will be addressed principally through the article on Leibniz's modal metaphysics. Gosh, that can really put your brain in. So that's up 38 minutes, and we're up to three in our first thing, which is going about double the rate I went through Kant, but there's a lot here. Well, it is interesting, and I hope you continue to listen and enjoy as I go through. I'm having the time of my life, not really, just going through this. The important thing is that I think really quantum physics and the Higgs boson and all this new particle physics really pulled us apart. in this complicated way. I think there is a mathematical answer. I think what you do is you get scientists or people coming to this with school grade science, and they say, oh, these philosophers think this or that. I think we do have distinctive answers or insights which we can add to it. Thanks a lot for listening. Another story comes to a close. It's been a pleasure sharing this moment in time with you. How you discover truly amazing things, understand them, and tell others. Thanks for listening.